Wednesday, 21st of June, meeting the Parliament, the Honourable Chief Inspector.
Mr. Speaker, before the House continues its ordinary business, this is the first time that we meet after the passing of Juan Carlos Pérez, who was a long-time member of this House. In fact, he was a member of this House from 1984. Until 2003. In that time, in those just shy of 20 years of membership of this House, Juan Carlos Pérez became an essential part of the way that debates were carried out, of the rigor with which opposition did its job at the time that he was a member of the GSLP opposition, and of the way that government did its work in the time that he was an essential part of the GSLP government from 88 to 96. And no less rigor was applied by him as a member of opposition between 96 and 2003. A lot of things have been said about Juan Carlos since he passed away. The Honourable Joe Bassano and I have had the opportunity to reflect publicly, as many of us on this side of the House have done, publicly and privately, and the impact that Juan Carlos has had on our community, on his human qualities, and on his political qualities. But today in this House, I would just pause for a moment before I ask the House to observe a minute's silence for the passing of one of its long-standing members to reflect on Juan Carlos as a parliamentarian. He was always robust in debate, but always highly well-prepared. Juan Carlos was not a man whose arguments would fail for lack of understanding or lack of preparation. And if there was a person who has not been a leader of this House, who has had the political acumen, who has had the depth of understanding of the politics of this community, it is certainly Juan Carlos Pérez. And perhaps the biggest accolade I can pay him, Mr. Speaker, is to reflect on the things that the Honourable, the former Chief Minister and Leader of the House, Mr. Peter Kahana, said of Juan Carlos in the course of a particularly prickly exchange with me after Juan Carlos had left, commending me to learn from Juan Carlos Pérez and telling me that, you know, whilst I might be talking nonsense, which was the usual term of endearment for the former Chief Minister who spoke right to me, he might say, Juan Carlos Pérez was in parliamentary terms matchless. And when your opponents recognize your contribution like that, I think you show what you've given your community. So I would call in the House, Mr. Speaker, before we hear other tributes from members who might wish to speak, to observe a minute's silence in the honor of Juan Carlos Pérez.
The Honourable Mr. Bassano. Mr. Speaker, of all of us here, I shared more of my life with Juan Carlos than anybody else. Both as a trade unionist, and as a member of parliament, and in everything to do with the Volta's political life. He was not a politician. He was somebody that had politics flowing through his veins instead of blood. So there was no time in the day or the night or the day of the week when politics did not enter into his life and mind. And everything that I've been able to contribute, both in government and in opposition and in the trade union, would have been much less effective and much less likely to have been successful had it not been for the fact that I had him on my side, constantly working with me, learning from me and teaching me. And we made a team that was totally dedicated as parliamentarians, as trade unionists, political activists to the welfare of Gibraltar, as we say, and in the best interest of all sectors of our community. Juan Carlos, notwithstanding in the fact that we had to argue a point, had no problem in being forceful, had turned across the South ever since we first became involved. So we had close friends in the AACR when we were the opposition, and close friends in the DSD when that was a party opposite us, and of course, in the DSD family, he was the life of the party. And, you know, it's the life of the party, and we're going to miss it.
Honorable Edmund Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I echo the words of the Father of the House, Juan Carlos, certainly has friends from both sides of his house, even has friends from those who like to hang around outside his house. He was one of those gentlemen who had that ability, like the members of his party say, to be able to fight the point to the end, but always be effective, and that's not come easy. I remember, I'm going to speak about it as well. I first came across Juan Carlos in the late 1960s when we were near young school children and we were deputy head teacher of the speaker. And there was the remains of the tail end of sort of the debating societies in school. And many of the sort of kicked out of the hat on this side of the world. And I remember really, really debating that there was Juan Carlos side because, boy, did you have the past side in here ever to speak against his argument? He used to be fond of himself as well, how many hours he spent on the road, but he had that ability of having very well argumented point of view put forward, like I said before, with respect to his fighting point. And having left school and having done the many things that he did, I also had some deep contact with him in the trade union, although I was not in the CNG, being a civil servant, I was in the GCA. He was someone that actually inspired enthusiasm, and when we come to be correct, he was very much always involved in that big battle for politics in the early 70s. Yeah? And a certain percentage of that success must be attributed to one family, either whatever he did directly or his mere support for the main negotiators, such as the branch of his family, the family was at the time. He then, Mr. Peter, then has fond memories. He then had the portfolio of Minister for Government Services, and at one stage when Stephen Ellis and I were involved with the Teachers Association, we used to have meetings with him, figuring somewhere in Europe what he had his office. And if you went well prepared, he did actually acknowledge when you were right. Okay? He was very honest and very frank, and I think our best successes at the time, the senior member certainly was fighting the points of excellence and so on. And his trade union background, I think, made him manage to convince the Wakanda that the teachers should be paid. Yeah? So, to go with Carlos, I know much of giving you as well a bit of a tough time because he was always a true representative of the workers, even though he had a continuity looking after the government. So, he never betrayed what was, as the senior member rightly said, running through his veins. Yeah? That fight for the workers. So, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of this side of the House, we offer up condolences to his mother, Angela, to his sister, and to all those
relatives of his and the overall family of different people, those who different people.
The Honourable Madeleine, how's that going?
Mr. Speaker, it is with great sadness that we once again find ourselves paying tribute to a departed colleague from the world of the Gulf of Politics. To describe Gonzalez Perez only as a founding member of the GSOP does a disservice to the countless hours that Mr. Perez dedicated himself to his particular political cause, from almost his constant presence on the party's office to his long tenure as editor of the GSOP's newspaper. There is, I am sure, no political development over the last 40 years in Gibraltar that has not warranted his astuteness nor his opinion, and I am sure that the members opposite all feel greatly indebted to his advice and guidance. Like Robert Moore, Joseph Goodbye, and Charles Buffon, who all sadly left this world before him, Juan Carlos Perez is a committed socialist who always had Gibraltar's interests at heart, and like theirs, his loss will be keenly felt. It must be remembered, Mr. Speaker, that in the late 1980s and 1990s, Mr. Perez played a significant role in developing the necessary telecommunications infrastructure to support Gibraltar's burgeoning economy, and this important contribution for our community deserves all of our appreciation. Of course, Mr. Perez was a political adversary of my father and his party, but he always treated him with a respect and admiration that was mutually reciprocated, and I can remember since a very young age. I personally always found Mr. Perez willing to give me much of his time, and we both enjoyed many discussions in the piazza, which was very much his political turf. I liked being in the company of this larger-than-life personality, and I am very saddened by the loss of such a strong political presence. I would like to convey my most heartfelt condolences to his family, his friends, all his political colleagues, while offering the consolation that Juan Carlos's legacy in this house will live on for many generations.
One of the great joys of teaching. The Honourable Joseph Garcia.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Juan Carlos was, I first met Juan Carlos as a family friend, so he was somebody I would see on a regular basis in the days of the thin moon and the old rock, which probably most people here want to remember. I think it was something. And in 1999, when I was first elected, I had the pleasure of serving with him in the House for that. To the family of my election was in the tragic death of Robert Moore, followed by Mr. Nelson. And I had the pleasure of serving within this house from then until 2002. And he was an expert teacher, a political strategist, who had a brilliant political mind. I think that's already been said. And certainly his performances in this chamber speak for themselves. The fact that he was admired and liked by friends and by political opponents alike. So I'd like to express my most sincere condolences to his mother and her friends, to his friends and family.
Let me not jump the gun. Is anybody else wish to pay tribute to the Honourable Charles de Fisela?
Thank you, Speaker. Juan Carlos and the father of the house were the two individuals that welcomed me into this GSOP family many, many years ago. And I enjoyed many, many, many a night at the Yale Watch, which my colleague has just mentioned, sharing his company, his intelligence, and his wit. I think I've ever met somebody who has the same level of political intelligence that he has, and to boot with a wit that is pretty much unbeatable, a speed of tongue, which is really quite terrifying. But I think for me that the one thing I take from Juan Carlos is not that he did 20 years of politics, which of course we all know and that is well documented, but he spent a life of giving, and that is what I think is really quite incredible. helping, giving, and serving the people of this community in any walk of life. It wasn't just with the union. Anybody that needed help had an open door and a desire to greet, to welcome, and to help in whatever way he possibly could. And for me, the biggest thing about this huge political giant for man was his ability and his sheer desire to help and give to others throughout the entirety of his life. And for that, I think he should be well remembered. And I also join in offering my sincerest condolences to all of those, of course, his family and all of his colleagues. One of the great joys of teaching in the secondary school in Gibraltar is the fact that many of your former pupils become in later life your closest friends. And that was very much the case with Gonzalo Pérez, as far as I'm concerned. Politically, we were opponents, but always friends. Politics never divided them. I'd like to recall the young man that Maurice Iberes and I taught in the grammar school. Juan Carlos was mischievous, with a great sense of fun, and he was never afraid to question and to stand up to the teachers if he felt that an injustice had been committed. But there is an incident that I always remember very, very fondly. We were staging, the school was staging the play A Man for All Seasons by Robert Bolt. And Juan Carlos was cast as Everyman. Everyman is effectively the prologue of the play. And when the curtain started, Juan Carlos walked onto the middle of the stage because he was dressed in a black leotard. And looking at himself, he said, he uttered those immortal words of the opening of the play, "Is this a costume? Does this say anything? It barely covers one man's nakedness." I always remember him, and I always used to chide him about it. I always remembered it in particular when I used to put on the yellow robe, which was a different sort of costume, if you like. It's a very sad year, I think, for this Parliament. 2017 is proving to be a very, very sad year. We've lost more than one former parliamentarian, and I'm sorry to say that being in contact with some other former members, we could prepare ourselves for even further sadness before the year is out. That is the way of the world. And so back to this one. Can I, on behalf of this side of the House, thank members opposite for their very kind words and that I could just for the characterization of the new people? Can I just say that if Mark Allen was here, I think he probably said, this is too many military. You go to Parliament to do politics, just get on with it. Thank you.
We now continue with answers to oral questions. We commence with question number 337. The questioner is the Honourable Alex Lennox.
Mr. Speaker, can the government disclose what series of manifestations have been presented for the deserved of one vote?
Answer the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer the question together with questions 338 and 339.
Question number 339, the Honourable Alex Yannis. So, two fields.
Mr. Speaker, who are the special owners of the Vote for One Vote?
Question number 339, the Honourable Alex Yannis.
Mr. Speaker, what consideration is being paid by the Vote for One Vote? And did the government consult or advocate a site for alternative uses?
Answer the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the operators of the One Vote have told the government that they expect to provide a tourism facility as part of the overall wine package experience, not only to see the wine facility, but also to experience the World War II tunnels and cinemas. This will not, however, be organized or controlled by the government. It will be a part of the One Series operation. We are pretty upset that the combination of one tasting and visit to the World War II experience could attract tourists from cruise liners. The beneficial owners are the Volta One Volt Limited. The consideration already paid by the Volta One Volt for the XWC station is £350,000. The government did not consult or advertise the site for alternative uses. The Volta One Volt approached the government on this project. It was further that this was a unique project, perfectly suited for those chambers which have little other use, and which would provide the Volta with economic activity and employment, and could attract wealthy wine connoisseurs and tourism in general.
Mr. Speaker, could I ask the government, is there a set loose or a control mechanism whereby the government will be able to monitor the success of this project, and in any event, if it seems that the project is not returning the economic activity that is envisaged, it can call back the land and operate for alternative use?
Mr. Speaker, this is not land in the normal sense, it's money, inside the rocket itself. There is a lease which regulates the activity and which the operators have to abide by. I don't have the terms of the lease given, but also there is a little bit of lease which they're paying in exchange for the premium.
And one final question, Mr. Speaker. Has the government been consulted on what the entrance fee to the tunnels in this site will be?
I know we have been no consultation, certainly that I know of. And obviously, the option is open to them not to have a fee if they say with it.
One final supplementary. Mr. Speaker, does the government know for how long the lease will run? Of the Secretary of State, if there's something that you need to materialize from these questions.
If you have that information, but I don't have it with me, then I'm going to take off on the question, and then I'm going to have to answer it, and then we should probably answer it.
Question number 314, the Honourable Ellis Young.
Can the government state what involvement it has with setting up an assistant to vote for certain clubs, together with details of any contract it may have entered into?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and Sport.
Speaker, talking about the cap is a fully private concern. They are paid to the Water Tourist Board for assistance in 2016. The duty to be assisted in marketing the service in a social media platform, proofreading and helping with the massive use by the operators, adding details on the product to the DTB website, displaying leaflets in the DTB information processes and at events. This, Mr. Speaker, is similar to the assistance provided to most private concerns that take the initiative to produce a tourism related product. In addition, the DTB provided the sum of £4,689 to Talking Clap Limited for its marketing materials that the company produced, including leaflets and branded giveaways to include the Gibraltar branding. The sum also went towards grave signs on the post and microchip contained therein. There is no contract entered into with the DTB. The company sought its necessary permission from the relevant authorities to roll out their business.
Mr. Speaker, is it then safe to say that the private entity can sell on the business or decide not to maintain the sound on the given that there is no contract with the government has a way of controlling what happens with this business which is being run essentially on the Gibraltar sea site?
Because I mentioned there is no contract, and there is certainly no prohibition of the company behind this initiative having its share sold to anyone.
It is, of course, subject to permissions being given by the government, and that is how it was set up. It was set up by seeking permission from the government, and the government giving permission to place these flats in various places, providing certain information. And therefore, if anything which would have concerned the government was to happen, that permission can simply be withdrawn, and then the council has to be taken down by the government if necessary, because they are fairly on government property, and therefore subject to, at the moment, no contract, no lease, just a license, and also that license can be terminated by the government as well.
Question number 341, the Honourable Ellis Yaman.
The Speaker, has the government made any progress in the launch of a new business proposal at the CI website?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and Sport.
As the Speaker, the Devoted Tourist Board is now working with a parent provider of the website to launch a new version of the site. This is scheduled to happen late September, early October of this year.
Question number 342, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Raum.
Can government explain what is the licensing criteria and charges for?
Answer the Minister for Tourism, Employment, Commercial Aviation and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, the criteria for licensing a small charter craft for use within designated areas in British Gibraltar territorial waters is stipulated under 74 of the Small Vessels Mooring Control Rule 2015 and the Seaside Cargo Boat Rule 1999.
Mr. Speaker, I understand the criteria at the moment as per the law, but my question leads to ask whether the government would be looking at perhaps making the criteria more stringent, given the recent surge of pleasure craft with the new marina, and also the accident that we saw a couple of weeks ago that might be telling us that our youngsters may find it very easy to get on a pleasure craft without having enough knowledge of sailing or of the pleasure craft itself. Would the government be willing to make these laws more stringent?
The question asked about licensing criteria rather than the enforcement of the laws and whether the laws should be changed. The licensing criteria, as I have indicated, is already in the legislation. In fact, what we did, although the Honourable Member said the criteria is not, may not be stringent enough, depends on how one looks at it, what we did was to actually set out, for the purposes of the new marina, we set out the criteria in legislation under the Small Vessels Mooring Control Rule 2016, and actually set out what the criteria for licensing and for permitting vessels in the small vessels or small boat marina at the Mid Harbour marina should be. That was first reported with a state of certainty and clarity, and therefore so that nobody could say, well, I've been treated unfairly because this criteria has been improperly applied, or the questions that you have not been applied to the required standards or properly in my case. And therefore, there are steps that need to be taken, documents which need to be produced, and very clear certainty in the legislation as to what the criteria should be. The Honourable Member mentioned issues about who can use the craft. Clearly, the legislation sets out who can use the craft, and it is a matter for enforcement. Do we need stricter controls? That is perhaps something that can be looked at. We introduced, when we made the changes that we did for the purposes of the small boat marina, Honourable Members will recall that I also announced changes to the Seaside Pleasure Boat Rule to be effective, to require strict criteria in relation to jet speed, particularly in relation to age limits and proficiency certificates in relation to jet speed. So that criteria is already there in relation to jet speed. We also introduced a new category of vessels, which we called exempt vessels, which were vessels which could be exempt from the fast launch control rule, subject to the vessels not exceeding 40 knots, and subject also to the user of that vessel person who has been licensed having the necessary competency certificate, which is generally an RYA, local vocabulary certificate, which is required by the captain of the course, and also insurance in relation to that lecture. I can also say that we have set up, under the legislation which we produced for the small boat arena, the small vessels advisory committee or board. And that is a board that is tasked statutorily with looking at all aspects of small vessels, including use, licensing criteria, insurance, proficiency. And there has been advice given to me. I have met with the board. There has been advice given to me, particularly in relation to insurance, which would cover all vessels, all motorized vessels. And that is advice that I have accepted. This is a recommendation that has been made by the board to me, and we're in the process of looking at the legislation that needs to be changed in order to introduce a mandatory provision, which we already have for fast vessels, we already have for exempt vessels, we already have for jet skis, and we're about to introduce it for all vessels with that are the motorized nature. And that's the legislation I hope to either bring to Parliament if we need to change it up. And I'm seeking advice at the moment on that, or introduce it by regulations and make an announcement on it. But I hope to do that very quickly indeed.
Question number 343, the Honourable Alex Yaman.
Mr. Speaker, can the government say how many residents and my families are living at Hillside together with a breakdown of their long-term previous accommodation breaking down into A, private accommodation, B, government rental housing, C, CHC ward, C, other elderly residents or centres?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, there are 42 residents living permanently at Hillside. All 42 residents were transferred from CHC ward. Before admission to hospital, 28, out of the 42 residents lived in government rented accommodation, and 14 resided in private accommodation. No residents from the elderly residential centres have been transferred to Hillside.
Question number 344, the Honourable Alice Yammer.
Mr. Speaker, can the government disclose the selection criteria in choosing the residents for their side?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the criteria selection was turned to large, considering each individual's diagnosis and condition. A panel, including GHA and care agency professionals, were commissioned to assess eligibility. The same criteria for admission of dementia patients to EAS was followed. All the residents admitted to Hillside have been diagnosed with different stages of dementia.
Can the Minister disclose whether residents of other elderly residential centres were considered as part of the change over the moving in into Hillside?
Mr. Speaker, the admission criteria for Hillside is the same as it would be for any admission to any other area of science that is medical wellness. The additional difference is that there's also a mental capacity because of the language and for long Hillside is designed primarily to care for persons who suffer from dementia and Alzheimer's. The applications are assessed by the care agency and they prioritize individuals based on need. The only gentleman may also know this before, under the previous administration, there was a list and it was a first time on a first basis. I think it was my honorable predecessor, either Duncan Best and Samantha Sacramento, who decided that it made more sense, given the progressive nature of the disease, Alzheimer's and dementia, that there should be initial space on the person's need rather on living the first unit.
Question number 345, the Honourable Alex Yaman.
Mr. Speaker,
Can the government state how many diagnosed Alzheimer's dementia sufferers currently reside at each of the following: John Cochrane Ward, Castle Ward, Mount Severn, and St. Bernard's Hospital?
Answer: the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the number of residents or patients diagnosed with Alzheimer's and dementia in the named areas is as follows: John Cochrane Ward, 16, Chelsea Ward, 8, Mount Vernon, 72, and St. Bernard's Hospital, 6.
Question number 346, the Honourable Alex Young.
Speaker, can the government disclose the names of the care providers who are invited to express interest in providing the necessary staff for the mental day center, together with A, the day from which the invitation was sent to each care provider, and B, the closing date?
Answer: the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 247.
Question number 347, the Honourable Elefiana.
Mr. Speaker, can the government disclose the names of the care provider who is invited to express interest in providing the necessary staff of the mental residential facility, together with A, the date on which the invitation was sent to the care provider, and B, the closing date of the
date? Answer: the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, as I have previously stated, it is not the policy of the government to publicly name any company that is approached and invited to apply for a public contract. I can confirm, however, that as I have already noted in response to previous answers to questions 727 of 2016 and 51 of this year, all 6 known local care providers were approached in respect to the Mental Day Centre. Invitations were sent on the 7th of September of last year, and on the closing date of the 15th of September of last year, 3 applications were received. In respect of Hillside, the mental residential facility, 5 invitations were sent on the 5th of June 2015, and on the closing date of the 2nd of June 2015, 5 applications were received.
Question number 348, the Honourable Alex Lemon.
Can the government provide a monthly figure since the 1st of April 2016 to date of how much has been paid to care providers in return for subcontracted nurses by the GHA, B, the Care Agency, and C, Elderly Residential Services?
Answer: the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the estimated information subject to audit is in the schedule. I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman.
I suggest we proceed with the next question, and then the Honourable Christian may come back once he has had an opportunity to study the study.
Question number 349, the Honourable Alex Yaman.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a monthly schedule from 1st of April 2016 to date of how much has been paid to each care provider in return for subcontracted care workers by A, the CHA, B, the Care Agency, and C, Elderly Residency Services?
Answer: the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 350.
Question number 350, the Honourable Alex Lamont.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide a schedule per financial year from 1st of April 2012 to the 31st of March 2016 of how much has been paid to care providers in the sense of subcontracted measures by the GHA, B, the Care Agency, C, Elderly Residential Services?
Answer: the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the estimated information is subject to audit. It is in the schedule. I now hand over to the Honourable Gentleman. In respect of answer to question 350, the information requested is only available from the 1st of April 2015. As previously, invoices submitted for the Care Agency and DRS were first service and not per grade. The information for the period of the 1st of April 2015 to the 31st of March 2016 is as follows. DHA, £0. Care Agency. Grand Home Care, £450,174. Rainbow, £1,188,061. ERS, Grand Home Care, £1,288,237. Rainbow, £87,802.
Sorry,
Mr. Speaker, I just want to discover an answer to question 348. I wonder if you're interested in explaining the use of subcontracting nurses in the DHA during the month of March. That obviously out of scale compared to previous months. Is this something the DHA is doing differently to what it was doing before?
Could Mr. Clinton repeat the question, please?
Referring to Mr. Clinton, the schedule to the answer to question 348 for 2017 for the DHA for the period of March 2017, there's a number there of £102,419.05 for that particular month. But if you look at the previous month, certainly from October to February, zero. And other months certainly a figure much lower than that. I couldn't explain to how why it is that the number is so large and not is the government or the DHA doing something different in respect of subcontracting nurses.
Mr. Speaker, there has been no change in policy in that respect, and therefore I do not have the answers to why there was, as you rightly said, a sizable jump in March. I dare say, and I will confirm this for the Honourable Gentleman, but I dare say that the amount we collected in March, in fact, it is the answer. If the Honourable Gentleman looks at the column just next to the amount, it says that the period relating to the 102,000 is from the 1st of January to the 20th of March. So it includes 2 months. Of 2017, which would explain 2 months only. So there are three other months which are appear to be unaccounted for. So I will go back to my, in fact, I will email my office and hopefully during the course of this session I have an answer for you.
Just a clarification guidance from the Minister saying it should be able to interpret this schedule correctly. The schedule which says answers question 350 and 349 of 2017. Could the Minister clarify which part relates to 349, which tables relate to 349 and which tables relate to 350? So there's one is for care workers, subcontracted care workers, and the other one relates to such and such of ministers. If the minister could clarify the tabling and the jump.
Mr. Speaker, the answer in the table relates to text in 349. The information that is concerning 15 was the one that was came across for the house. So it is it did not have said answer question 15 that it was put in the house.
Question number 351, the Honourable R. M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise the written readmission rate for ocean views in the year ended 31st of March 2017?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the readmission rate for ocean views in the year ending 31st of March of this year is 2.85%. It is failing to highlight, Mr. Speaker, that the NHS benchmarking report found a 9% readmission rate in the UK in 2015. Evidencing that, for Mr. Speaker, our excellent professionals at ocean views should be congratulated for their outstanding work in ensuring such a low readmission rate. I will have more to say about the business piece in my budget again.
Question number 352, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise the average cost per day per bed reached of St. Bernard's Hospital, Mount Alvernia, and Ocean View in the financial year 2016-17?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the average cost per day per bed for St. Bernard's Hospital depends on the level of dependency. Therefore, the cost of a bed can vary from £340 to £515. The average cost per day per bed for ocean view is £338. The average cost per bed per bed for Mount Alvernia is £192.
Question number 353, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise what is the policy for renewal of health centre charge by self-employed individuals?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the renewal of health charge for self-employed individuals is only initiated when the Department is satisfied that individuals have settled their social insurance contributions by the 15th of every month, as stipulated by the Social Insurance Regulations 1955. If a self-employed individual is up to date with social insurance payments, then proof of payment and a renewal form would suffice to renew the health card. The DHA ensures that a settlement agreement has been reached if the individual is in arrears. Failure to conform to the agreement will result in the DHA suspending their rights to medical care. It is important to note that the individual will still be entitled to emergency medical treatment. As with any process, there may be cases of specific issues which may require referral to the registration board for individual consideration. This is done by an appeal.
Mr. Speaker, ready to the Minister's response. I've come across a number of individuals, unfortunately, with varying advice that's been given to them, some of which is contradictory. I'd be grateful the Minister could talk out of the House if a self-employed individual is entirely up to date. How long would his health centre card be valid for? Would it be issued as a 5-year card?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
I'd like to for that answer, and I will go back to the constituents and advise them as first. If a self-employed individual is given contrary advice, who should they contact and who's responsible for it? Would it be the tax department or the GHA?
Mr. Speaker, we can either contact me directly by email or we can contact Ray Spencer, who's the primary care center manager. But either of us will attend to the president.
Mr. Speaker, perhaps it's not a question, but you should be aware that individuals have been asked to pay in advance, either monthly or for an entire year, to get health care card for a year. I'm happy to share this information with them outside the Speaker's declaration.
Mr. Speaker, that may have been in cases where the individual would have been insignificant to you for a number of years, and therefore we would ask for a reasonable amount of cash payments so that we don't find ourselves in a position where a payment of arrears agreement is due, and that in the very first month we're once again in the position of arrears, and that there's established trust between that particular person who owes arrears and the DHA. A reasonable amount is asked, but if any individual feels that the amount being asked is reasonable, that they can feel free to write to the director.
Mr. Speaker, may I think that I can give the Minister a first hand opinion, having had to assist my son, who happens to be a person for a person. Shortly after Christmas, he was refused an appointment in the health centre because he was now on the self employed and had to produce to get all the injury documents for taking through the contribution. He was told that the card would be renewed for a month, to the end of March, and was therefore advised that he paid to the end of the financial year in advance as he did to the end of June. Coming now to that expiry date, again he's been advised as recent as the last few days to pay the whole of 17, 18 years in advance of taking through the contribution. Because if it's just, you know, as this week progresses. So there seems to be some contradictory information feeding through from the political side. You know, I would be grateful for the Minister to look at it because, you know, there are several cases that we know of. And it always makes a certain sense that government has to protect the payments that we made. You cannot put, you know, a heavy burden on young self-employed people that are all encouraged to start off, you know, having to pay a whole year for the payments in advance.
Mr. Speaker, I agree with the Honourable Gentleman that such a request would be counted as serious and unacceptable. So I would happily, after the session of the House, after the budget session, call in those who I have to say is formidable and very well acquainted with the work that she does. I really must be individual cases which, unforgivably and unacceptably, have fallen to the net. But certainly, the assumption that we could not take them out and speak to them community yesterday. And I thank them for bringing them to my own.
Question number 354, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state what specific sentencing reforms it is looking to address in the context of the Law Reform Commission?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the particular areas of sentencing reform to be looked at are yet to be finalised, as it is my intention and forecast in the Commission to consult the Law Commissioners before a final decision is made. I refer the Honourable Gentleman to my
opinion. He's answering the question together with 3855.
I will answer this question together with question 355.
Question number 355, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state the names of experts that were appointed to the proposed Law Committee?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I refer the Honourable Gentleman to my previous statement from this matter, where I stated that I intend to review local 17 laws to ensure that the cater for the needs of the water, rather than being tied to 17 guidelines which have evolved from other jurisdictions, but which in particular retreat and may not necessarily apply to us. It should also be noted that I have in the past said that there appears to be a number of classes of offence where, due to local circumstances, following local guidelines not always produce appropriate sentences for the water. These include, for example, offences of violence and sexual offences. It is these types of offences that I think should be looked into by the Commission. As the Honourable Gentleman was himself said, the issue of sentencing guidelines is a matter for the Honourable Chief Justice in consultation with me. Any recommendations in this area will be communicated to the Chief Justice under Section 484 of the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Act 2011 for him to take into regard when deciding whether or not to make any changes. Additionally, it may be that the Commission will look into offences which have been part of our statute book for a number of years and which were legislated with maximum fines, which did not refer to the standard scale of fines, but rather for a set amount, which with a passage of time would make the amount irrelevant. In undertaking an exercise in examining such offences,
The Committee is able to propose new funds referring to standards care, which are more in keeping with the seriousness of these offences. Finally, I am keen that the Commission be tasked with an examination of the parole system and the amount of time the person serving custodial sentences must serve before being eligible to be released and licensed. This is particularly relevant given the differences between the UK and local systems, which are not reflected in local sentencing practice. In accordance with Clause 4 of the Bill, it is intended that there will be initially appointed at least 4 commissioners, in addition to the Magistrate Attorney General, who will be an ex officio member, and the Minister of Responsibility for Justice, who will act as the chairman. At least 2 of the commissioners serve funds with lawyers. Of course, given the fact that the bill will be debated in a few weeks' time, the Honourable Gentleman will forgive me if I do not give the names of the persons who have intended to appoint as commissioners today, and I hope you will allow me to keep something for my budget speech as the bill's second reader.
I'm grateful for that response. Would the Honourable Minister agree that this is a significant undertaking in terms of the Commission, its contribution, and also its terms of effort, that it is a significant undertaking?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I agree with it too. At the same time, we're very excited about the project and the work that we've been undertaking. I will tell you that the persons that we have approached to be appointed as walking materials have all accepted, and as I said, we have been those names in the course of our budget.
Just one further supplementary question. How long does the government envisage this process will take? And the reason I ask the question about significant undertaking is that when we're looking at which was previously the development of questions in the area of sentencing and sentencing notes by the judiciary. Obviously, there will be some consistency with what's been drawn from the United Kingdom in terms of their sentencing practice. And therefore, does the government have any idea of how long this process will take to develop that sentencing notice?
The answer is no, on the basis that, as I explained at the beginning of my answer, I intend to consult with the law commissioners on which task we should tackle first. It may be that we decide at the first meeting to deal with discrete matters that can be dealt with as the deputy and second deal with the rest of the mandate. But as I said, it will be decided by the law commission at the first meeting, and at that point I think we have a clear idea of what we are able to realistically achieve in whatever is left of this kind of weapon.
Question number 356, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state the number of fraud or dishonesty cases which are currently being investigated by the Employer Civil Protection Unit?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 357 and 358.
Question number 357, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state from the number of fraud or dishonesty cases currently being investigated by the IPP, how many have resulted in criminal proceedings being brought?
Question number 358, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state from the number of fraud or dishonesty cases currently being investigated by the IPP, the duration of the investigation is categorised as the following: 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, or in excess of 12 months?
On to the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the Royal Force Police can confirm that there are currently 12 major fraud investigations locally in Gibraltar. This, however, does not take into account the numerous investigations that the IPC assists other jurisdictions with. There are currently 4 major fraud cases where persons have been charged and are before the court. Additionally, the schedules which are imparted to the Honourable Member set out the number of minor fraud and dishonesty offences which have been reported to the RDP during the last financial policing year. The second column shows the number of unresolved crimes, which means the matter is still under some form of investigation or before the court. With regard to the overall crime reported to the RDP in the 2016-17 policing year, and related to minor fraud and dishonesty offences, the detection rate contained in the schedule has been recorded by the IPP. A detection is recorded only once the person has been judicially dealt with by the court and has been found to be responsible for the crime, or if the police caution has been withheld. investigations by the RGP, the major fraud offences are as follows. 1 month, one case. 3 months, two cases. 6 months, two cases. 9 months, two cases. 12 months, one case. In excess of 12 months, four cases. Mr. Speaker, it is impracticable in the sense of time consuming for the Royal Board of Police to transfer the duration of investigation for each minor fraud or dishonesty offence reported to the police.
Just one question arising from the answer that the Honourable Minister gave, without looking at this thing that was said, and I'll deal with that later on if I may, Mr. Speaker. And insofar as the categorisation of major and minor fraud cases, can the Minister confirm that those are categorised by reference either to value and or complexity?
Mr. Speaker, the RGP define a major fraud case as one assessed where the loss is in excess of £10,000, anything under is categorised as a minor fraud or dishonesty offence. So it's a numerical value attached as to whether it's classified as one or the other.
Question number 359, the Honourable D.A. Pinkney.
Mr. Speaker, who is performing the functions of Human Resources Manager at the DHA?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, a senior official, substituting to the grade of Senior Executive Officer, has recently covered this role.
Mr. Speaker, I understand that the former Human Resources Manager is now in the licensing office. Can the Honourable Gentleman explain why there's been a change in personnel occupying this particular post?
Mr. Speaker, I'm first thinking of the Honourable Gentleman's information is once again incorrect. The former Head of Human Resources at the DHA is not at the licensing office, but there has never been any comment in this House as to the movement of civil service from one department to another. They are interchangeable, those are the rules of the civil service, and they are neither subject to a referendum in the civil service as to whether people move or don't move, in particular at that grade, or indeed for debate in this House.
Nobody is wanting to debate this particular issue. They're wanting an understanding of whether any particular policy reasons as to the chance of this particular gentleman, who I know is occupying this particular post for some time, elsewhere. If I'm mistaken, he's being transferred to the licensing department. In fact, maybe it's the momentum that I've actually used because I've dealt with this particular individual. In relation to a residency permit, and indeed, because of my query in his new role, very well indeed. But it's the policy that I'm interested in, whether there are any policy reasons for this particular change.
Mr. Speaker, the policy is that civil servants are fully transferable, and that has been not just the policy, it's the terms and conditions of engagement of civil servants. We have very effective civil servants of every grade who do a very good job where they were and where they are. So there is no policy reason for anybody being moved, because moving people from one place to another is not a matter of policy. It's a matter of people playing to their strengths and doing the job that the government needs done in order to provide the public with the service that we endeavour to provide. The department, Mr. Speaker, which has not changed in nomenclature under my administration, but is the same department that would have been in place when he was in government, is the CSRO, Civil Status and Registration Office. We don't like those people in the board, Mr. Speaker, already spoken about.
Thank you.
Question number 360, the Honourable Ms. M.B. Hassan-Nam.
In connection with the appointment of the facilities manager or equivalent at the ERS, can the Minister for Health explain what the recruitment process has been for this post in the context of qualification and experience?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, today there has been no appointment to this post.
Mr. Speaker, can the Health Minister kindly confirm whether this post is open and will be filled, or are they looking to fill it?
Mr. Speaker, all I can tell you at this stage is that, from my understanding, there has been no movement in respect of this particular post since I became Minister for Health. General Lady Nelson, who we discussed in the past, is in the process of integrating ambulance medical services into the DHS, so we're currently evaluating all posts for those internal effectiveness. But as I say, since I was appointed Health Minister, there has been no movement in order to this question.
Question number 361, the Honourable Ms. M.B. Hassan-Nam.
In connection with the new appointment at the primary care clinic for the post of health visitor, can the Minister for Health explain what the recruitment process has been for this position in the context of qualification and experience?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, there has been no recruitment process for the post of health visitor, as the post is currently filled with a contact nurse.
Mr. Speaker, does the Health Minister consider it fair that there is another health visitor? Because I understand there are two health visitors, or there should be two health visitors at any time, and that the other health visitor only got the job by an interview process, presentation to panel, and is it fair that the latest recruit for this position hasn't had to go through the same challenge?
As I told the Honourable Lady, there has been a recruitment to the post. Therefore, at the point of the recruitment, the usual recruitment procedure will apply. And if that is what ordinarily happens, the person is requested to prepare a presentation, and I imagine that the myself or himself for an interview, then that would be the president before at that time. But currently, there is already a contact nurse that is occupying the place.
Mr. Speaker, can the Health Minister, or perhaps the Education Minister, give us some clarification that there is currently a junior staff nurse who was sent to the UK through the education back door, a candidate well known to the GSLP family, and will be placed in this position in a very short time frame?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady and I have discussed this in the bunker number 6 at the flat door downstairs between Affecting Corbillo House, and have told her that her information is incorrect. She's listened to me on the subject. I have my principal secretary, Mr. Brown, write to her. Clearly, unfortunately, on this occasion, she seems not to trust what I told her by email, but I can assure her that what I tell her in the past year, I do so as if I were answering her in this house, and I always live on the basis that all the decisions that I take will be subject to her scrutiny and to the scrutiny of honorable members of the state. Let me just tell her that her information is so incorrect that this lady to whom she alludes is not a junior nurse. She is a registered general nurse, which I think we know is higher than nursing assistant, higher than the role of nurse. She's a tier one nurse. So please let her leave this house in the knowledge that her information is true and the people of October only. I've told about the email, I know said so, and the speech is fair, and I can assure her that there is no other explanation other than what I've already said to her orally and in writing, and now under my responsibility in the task to give to her for in front of the slogan.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Minister for Health for his explanation, and it is indeed true that I have been facing this matter for many months, because I and many workers within the DHA consider the situation very disconcerting, and it is true that the Minister often, any time that I ask for any information, he can see that I've come in good faith. This is why I've been waiting for this question, but I have to say that it's precisely because I haven't been satisfied with the answers given by his officials that I have felt a need to raise it. So perhaps if I can ask the question, once this candidate completes her studies and comes back, should she be given the position? Perhaps the Minister for Health will indulge in answering whether all this coincidence, so we say, in placing her was in fact a better company or not.
Mr. Speaker, I've also the Honourable Lady that information is correct. She is already a registered general nurse. The RDN is a tier one nurse. They undergo what I understand to be an excruciating 3-year degree, and she completed her BSc honours via the School of Health Studies. So I can assure her that this is not a degree, this is a fully qualified tier one profession. And at the point that the contract nurse's term of engagement expires, then, as I understand it from the supplementary information given to me, the position will be, in the usual manner, advertising family for people to apply. But let me also tell Mr. Speaker that since I have been the Health Minister, I have, on many different occasions, seeing a need for RGN or EMs in one part of the GHA, and without any internal vacancy or without any other person, I've asked the Director of Nursing whether we could reorganize and restructure the nursing cohort so that one ward could do with perhaps having less particular tier nurse and move to another. In other words, one thing some of this study would not be at all unusual if this lady who is currently undertaking the work, because she is a fully qualified nurse, at the point that the contract nurse's contract expires, I'm advised clinically by the Director of Nursing that she's suitable to carry out the post. But let me assure her that if she were not, she would not be placed in that position, because she knows me well enough to know that my first concern, as is the concern of every single person on this bench, is placing safety, dignity, and compassionate care by highly qualified and skilled people.
Mr. Speaker, I don't mean to interfere in the debate supplementary, but I'm afraid that the Honourable will allow me just to discuss the House quickly, because we're going to pay a tribute in a moment, and I can just ask the House to reflect as we go downstairs. But this is the first meeting of the House since the attack at the Manchester Arena, which incredibly is just over a month ago. The Borough Market attack, the Finsbury Mosque attack, and the tragedy at Grenfell Tower, in relation to the Manchester Arena, I think many of us could not believe that we were witnessing such a vicious terrorist attack at an event that was in effect attended by young people and children, some of whom were just having a great night out. At Borough Market, Mr. Speaker, a place where people were enjoying an evening out in that fantastic city, that is London, again, terrorists trying to change people's ability to enjoy freedom and liberty, especially in the city as cosmopolitan as London. And then, only 2 days ago at Finsbury Mosque, a cowardly attempt to create a conflict of religions and civilizations, where a man died because he was in the region of his place of worship, and his place of worship was attacked. And terrorists are terrorists, Mr. Speaker, whatever religion they may be, whatever religion or no religion that of the person that they kill. And this is in Brussels, another attempted attack, where I'm sorry to say the French Voltairians who are in the region of the attempted attack were very lucky to be able to see that attack forces. It's also, Mr. Speaker, exactly a week since the horrific event of the Grenfell Tower, which has led us, of course, in Gibraltar to have to check quickly, as the Minister for Housing and the City Fire Brigade and all the other relevant parts of government have done, the work that's been done on our own high-rise buildings
I would say that would be said more, but we have seen such horrific scenes. Everyone watching the news, I think, would have been horrified and would likely have turned away to see what was happening in London. And I asked the House of Speaker to show a brief in this segment, condolences by reception, so that we may assemble downstairs for a minute silence at 12 o'clock, where we will be joined by His Excellency, the Governor, and by the religious leaders of our community. So that's the invite from us for now, Elizabeth.
The House will now have its opposition. We were dealing with supplementary arising from question 361. Any other supplementary?
Mr. Speaker, I'm sorry, I got cut off my line of thought a little bit, if I can just pick myself up again. I and the Minister for Health share very good relationships in the interest of this community, and he knows very well that where I can get answers privately in order to help people, I try not to go public if it's not needed. And I repeat, precisely because I wasn't satisfied by the answers I was being given in the DOJ, I have continued to broaden this issue. And I accept that the Minister for Health is trying to be forthcoming and from where he's standing, there is nothing untoward about this appointment. But let me just put it this way. If this candidate who has been given by the Department of Education, it seems, a scholarship to go and train for this post that hasn't been filled, and then this candidate comes back, and then this candidate gets this post, can the Minister for Health not understand why the public or even staff at the GSA might find it disconcerting that all the factors have lined up in order for this candidate to get the job?
Mr. Speaker, I think that the Honourable Lady needs to be reminded of the fact. The first fact is that there has been no appointment. Indeed, she's been standing, but in the course of the supplementary question, she once again said that there has been an appointment. As a fact, there has been no appointment. There is currently a contract nurse that is filling that position. I think it is unfair to this particular person to have suggested in her first supplementary to me that she has somehow got into the back door. This is a registered general nurse. I mean, can assure the Honourable Lady that they do not gift those degrees as though they were either confetti or fruit. They are hard degrees, and due to dint of her diligence and her perseverance, she qualifies as a registered general nurse, which is tier one of nursing. And we should congratulate our local brothers and sisters who go to the UK to be able to qualify in profession so we can quickly give them a job in and serve our community. Then after was successful in an application to do a further course of study for specialist community public health nursing scholarship. She wasn't gifted it by the Department of Education. She had to apply, as everyone else applies, and after the application and after due consideration by what I know are excellent professionals at the Department of Education, she was granted the right to attend Bournemouth University in September of last year, to be completed in summer of this year, to do the course of specialist community public health nursing. Mr. Speaker, further, it is important to note that in the GSA, and my honourable and illustrious predecessor will correct me if I am wrong, there is only one other humanitarian health visitor. In fact, I think there are only two health visitors in the entirety of the GSA. So we have a humanitarian who successfully completes a Bachelor of Science and becomes a top tier one registered general nurse. She then applies again to continue and further her education, and she is successful. She is given a scholarship. And all that we are saying to the Honourable Lady Officer, and I said this to her in the past and previously by email and when we meet socially, that she has not been appointed to this. Whether or not this lady will become the health minister in this particular place will not be determined by me, I can assure her. It will be determined on the basis of clinical advice and nothing else. So, no, Mr. Speaker, there is no back door. No, Mr. Speaker, there is no hanky panky. No, Mr. Speaker, this is being done entirely properly, and everyone on this side of the House will applaud the fact.
fact that a Gibraltarian has been successful as an RGM, has been successful to get his scholarship, and we have now a second Gibraltarian health visitor. And the fact that there are only two health visitors out of a complement of 500 nurses has to be by necessity that many Gibraltarians want to be health visitors. So good job.
Mr. Speaker, will the post of health visitor, given that there's a contract nurse at the moment, and the contract will be finishing in September, be opening up in September?
Speaker, as I came to have during the course of one of my answers to my supplementary, whether or not this person is appointed to the position, which is currently being filled in by the contact list will be determined by the clinical manager in consultation with the with the nursing director once the position becomes available, and whether or not she's successful will solely depend on the advice that I receive by the clinical nurse manager.
If I may assist, because this is nothing new, Mr. Speaker. There have been similar cases going back years, and I believe beyond when we came into office, in other disciplines. The only thing is that there are so few health visitors, this may affect people's attention. Midwives have regularly gone to study midwifery. Qualified nurses have got scholarships through the education department to study midwifery and have come back and have been slotted in to replace contract workers. This has been happening for years. There is nothing new, so I don't understand why this particular young lady has gone out of her way, who wants to specialize and train and take a place rightfully within the Rural Health Authority, is being singled out by the member offices.
Mr. Speaker, can I just say that I'm by no means singling out anybody. I'm trying to bring to the light an issue that is of concern to many GHA workers, and I think that they deserve an explanation. This is not about the individual, this is about procedure and process.
Just one question. In listening to these exchanges across the floor of the House, there appears to be an assumption on behalf of the on the part of the minister in his answers that this lady that is now qualified, that has recently qualified in the United Kingdom, is actually going to be applying for this particular post. Has the minister received an indication that is so, and that is why in his answers he's basically taking it as a given that this lady is going to be applying for this particular post?
Mr. Speaker, the question as posed by the Honourable Lady was suggesting a backdoor, and that is why I've answered it in the way that I have. But the fact that it's been explained to me by Mr. Van in the supplementary information is that this particular lady approached the acting director of nursing in September of 2016 that he was interested in pursuing this training and that he'd been successful in obtaining this scholarship, and they discussed the career opportunities and possibilities. But as I told the Honourable Lady, I will repeat to the Honourable Gentleman, there has not been a determination, I promise you, there has not been a determination, and the Honourable Gentleman, absolutely, that's all. As I've also said, it can be challenging a contract now. But once the contract expires of the vacancy will then be available, and then from within the GHA, they will make a determination of who is suitable. But the point I also make to the Honourable Lady is that there are only two. So she will not be the only person who can apply. The other five visitor ladies could also apply once the position becomes available.
Question number 362, the Honourable Ms. M.B. Hassan.
Is there a press officer stationed at the 7th floor of St. Bernard Hospital, and if so, what does his or her work entail?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, there is no press officer stationed at the 7th floor of St. Bernard Hospital.
Question number 363, the Honourable Ms. M.B. Hassan.
Hello. Has the Health Minister met with all heads of department at the GHO in order to listen to their concerns?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Mr. Speaker, what would I tell a few of the heads of departments who claim that they still haven't met with the Health Minister and are dying for the opportunity to voice their concerns?
That they're not the head of the department?
I believe there's some sort of discrepancy here because there are few who claim that they haven't met and are heads of department. So perhaps.
Mr. Speaker, perhaps to clear up any ambiguity, I've met with the medical director approximately 172 times for his team, the public health director 43 times. Obviously, he was good in a former life and not being subjected to me. As much as the medical director, clinical nurse manager around once a month, the human resources, the acting human resources manager, in 1768, I doubt that the profile has so much time, it's probably a lot more than that. The director of nursing, I've met with her this morning, I see her very regularly, I would say that perhaps 3 or 4 times a week. The director of finance, around 16 times. Ocean View manager around 43. The St. Bernard Hospital Operations manager around 11. The PPC manager 44% around 172, 173 times. And the IMT director around 12 or 13 times.
Question number 364, the Honourable Ms. M.B. Hassanan.
What 24-hour arrangements are there in place for patients that require mental assistance, especially on weekends?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, at present, there is assistance from the community mental health team during working hours and an on-call crisis team, composed of a consulting psychiatrist, a mental welfare officer and a registered mental health champion to deal with emergencies, assessments and admissions out of normal working hours. Mr. Speaker, I am delighted to report today in the South for the first time that actually yesterday, the community mental health team services will be further enhanced by the introduction of an outreach support component for community patients. Services will be provided by experienced qualified nurses who will be on call after normal working hours, including on weekends. The main aim is to offer an extra tier of support for our community patients outside normal working hours. Although still at embryonic stages, the new extension to the service will see the phased introduction of a number of new initiatives aimed exclusively at improving the quality of life for patients and carers in the community and will continue to develop as the services grow. It is important to speak that I think at this point to highlight the argument against the overall misattention that readmission rates is at 2.8%. And we hope that with this new community outreach service support, we will be able to do even better on that figure. It is important to know that although high standard of care is presently on offer, the new component will ensure that a more robust support network is available to patients after hours and will be a welcome addition to the existing on-call team. Some of the services that will be available will include a nursing after hours on call service from 5 o'clock in the afternoon until 8 in the morning, 7 days a week, including bank holidays, improved discharge packages incorporating more supportive structures for people moving back into the community from Ocean View, improved supervision and management of patient caseloads that require more input and monitoring, increased in frequency of home visits, and checking compliance with medication. Following necessary training, a mental health support line will be available to our patients' care, incorporating a combination of phone and physical sessions, and where necessary, linking with the excellent team at Clubhouse to offer advice and support. It is anticipated that this improved approach will have a positive impact in reducing the need for admissions or length of stay in hospital. And as a speaker, by way of additional information, I think it is also important to say that we are working with the Honourable, the Deputy Chief Minister, and the Honourable Chief Minister and I are very much in close discussions with the Prime Minister Walker, and we are working to look closely with funding for the additional community outreach program that I've just announced earlier.
Mr. Speaker, I congratulate the Minister and the Government for such a well thought out package, and I thank him as a citizen. I think it will benefit many, many people. Can I ask, when can we expect the service to be advertised and the number known to the public? Because I personally received many desperate pleas from people, and obviously I'm not equipped to deal with mental health issues. So I'm looking forward to the day when this will actually be up and running. Can we have some type of time frame, please?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. The process that we followed was that we opened a general vacancy for three enrolled nurses who've got specialized training in mental health. And those three enrolled nurses are now currently undergoing extra training to make sure that when they receive calls and indeed when they make house visits, which for me was one of the most important parts and components of the new strategy, that nurses are able to visit persons who are in the community, who have been discharged from those rooms, and they are able to check on medication and, of course, provide any other medical assistance that an enrolled nurse can provide. We should be in a position to the training having been completed in time to fully roll out this program by before the Parliament recesses this summer. So hopefully something in July.
Mr. Speaker, may I add my congratulations to the Minister along the road with the Honourable Lady. As the House will recall, we both debated the both separate motions to the House in relation to the continuity of care for mental health patients in the community, and that more should be done to help the most vulnerable in the community. May I ask the Minister whether this initiative, which is obviously much welcome on this side of the House, was a result of any review that was undertaken, and if so, would the Minister be willing to publish the details of that review?
Mr. Speaker, if the Honourable Gentleman is asking me whether it was part of a formal review, no, it was not. When I became Minister for Health, one of the things that struck me was that there should be a more robust and resilient community focus where we ensure that persons who've been discharged from those rooms do not return to open rooms, although there has already been, as I said before, a psychiatrist and the community mental welfare officer under there that deals with after hour support. In our estimation, it would not be returned, but not enough. And therefore, that is why we rolled out, and I have to say and congratulate Kelly and Christopher Polina, who have provided us with the clinical advice on that. And after having also received advice from Mr. Manuel Pereira and from other members of the community mental health team, that this additional level of support will be sufficient. But of course, I think any new pilot program that the government deploys will have to wait and see whether we enrolled in the program or whether that needs to be considered as a part of the program.
Mr. Speaker, I'm going to the Minister for the additional advice. Just one final question. Will an element of this service be available to families of service users who may have concerns?
Absolutely, Mr. Speaker, yes.
Question number 355, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Mr. Speaker, following on from the answer provided to question number 288 of 2017, is the Minister for Housing now in a position to say how many government dwellings are currently vacant and or derelict in the building?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Quality.
Mr. Speaker, as previously advised, we are undertaking an index study of all properties, and this is ongoing.
As we indicated, the Minister has an indication by when this study will be completed, so to avoid me having to make the question necessarily if I have a right question.
Mr. Mr. Speaker, and this is what it would be working now after the summer. However, the Honourable Gentleman may recall that he was asking a separate question about vacant flats, and there are figures in that it's a written question, so we get a bit of written answer. But the exercise that we are undertaking is in respect of flats that are available from no longer be on, we may decide that are beyond economic return.
Question number 366, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing provide an updated list of all the refurbishment works already fully completed, with details of commencement and completion dates and naming the individual blocks of flats or concerns within the following rental housing estate? A. Laguna Estate, B. Lattice Estate, and C. Modis Property Estate.
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Housing and Quality.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 267.
Question number 367, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing provide the rise and updated estimated completion date of pending refurbishment work, namely the individual blocks of flats worth in terms, still being undertaken at the following rental housing estate? A. Laguna Estate, B. Lattice Estate, and C. Modis Property Estate.
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, in answer to question 266 of 2017, the following refurbishment works have been completed. A. Rodney House, September 2013 to November 2016. B. George Yoga House, commencement September 2013, completion December 2016, Referendum House, September 2015 to December 2016, Constitution House, February 2014 to December 2016, Father O'Brien, June 2014, December 2016, Cookmore House, June 2014 to December 2016, the Sarah Valita House, August 2014 to November 2016, Ironside House, November 2014 to November 2016, and for Part 2, Tiger House, September 2014 to November 2016, Castle House, September 2013 to April 2017, Inside, November 2013 to April 2017, Wall House, February 2014 to April 2017, and Key House, September 2014 to May 2017. And in answer to question 367, the following are the target dates for completion of the refurbishment of the estate. Estate A, Laguna, December 2018. Estate B, Glasses, December 2017. Estate C, Morris Castle, December 2017.
Let me think that he's meant to give me comprehensive information. However, in respect of question 367, I did ask for the naming and the individual blocks of flats were concerned. It's so that, you know, when I do meet with tenants from various estates, I can then sort of home in and at least know for certain that a block that's still on the list of pending refurbishment work to be completed is not one that has been completed. And it allows the tenants to be in a better position to know if work is still to be carried out.
Mr. Speaker, the answer is phrased in the way that it is because we've moved on from the initial way in which we were phasing the work of the estate. Because as you can see from the list of blocks that I have highlighted in question 366, a lot of these blocks have been completed. So we're no longer working within the estate in phases as we were. So the way that we are working towards completion is works across the board in terms of all of it. So essentially, we have the same completion date for everything that remains in the refurbishment process.
I think I understand what you're saying, but if I give you one quick example, in question 366 for the Glasgow State, the Minister referred to Brother O'Brien House. In 367, by not holding him and not being able to provide him with the rest, the residents of Brother O'Brien are still or is anything now picked off and therefore no further work that can happen? Will that be the case? May the tenants may wish to get together and see the government that the work are not quite done as far as they would like to believe. This is why I thought this information could help to perhaps, you know, calm their fears.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and so far as Brother O'Brien and indeed all the other blocks that are listed in Part B of my answer to 366, all these are now completed. We are at a stage where we have completion, but we are finalising on the snagging of the completion line. But the answer to that is that we have completion for the defendant.
I'll leave you for that, Mr. Speaker, and it needs to be after the summer research. I can then satisfy any further questions.
Question number 368, the Honourable E.J. Davis.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of what new establishment work is intended to carry out at any government rental housing estate in the immediate future?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, we will continue to invest in the refurbishment of all government housing estates. And there is a programme of work to ensure that estates continue to be refurbished as well as maintained. More details will be announced in the specific estates to be tackled and dates when the work will be in completion.
Question number 369, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of remedial work undertaken and or work still to be undertaken and completed to the supply of a fresh water system at Alameda House in Alameda State, indicating if they are of a permanent or temporary arrangement?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, the fresh water supply at Alameda State was provisionally rerouted externally via corridors as an emergency measure. The provisional installation is currently being secured within the inner side of the common areas to afford protection against extreme weather conditions, vandalism, and accidental damages until a permanent rerouting solution is implemented as part of the forthcoming external refurbishment of Alameda House.
I'm grateful and certainly the tenants as well come back eventually the a more permanent thing will happen. Any possibility of an indication of the date when these external works would take place at Alameda House that will finalize the work that unfortunately had to be taken to the first quarter of the vice system at Alameda House?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, we're talking about Alameda House will in track with our refurbishment plan. It's envisaged that the external refurbishment of Alameda House will commence in January 2018.
Question number 370, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government state what arrangements are in place for those who have completed a custodial sentence, have no place to residence, and have a drug dependency issue, and they can immediately access? Have no place to residence, have drug dependency issues, can immediately access government accommodation?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, arrangements have been established between the Housing Department and all partner bodies where cases of people falling under this category are discussed at a multi-agency basis and suitable accommodation is identified in accordance with government allocation policy.
Just one further question arising from that. Does that mean, Minister, that there is someone, if released from prison having completed that custodial sentence, make sure their arrangements are either put in place before they simply make their application for urgent rehousing or advising? How does it work on a practical level for those people to
access accommodation in those circumstances. I'm grateful.
Because if you're under the new arrangement, we do not wait for someone to have completed their sentence, and this is where the housing department works with the prison authorities and social workers or probation officers or drug workers, depending on the offender, to assist them in their reintegration prior to release. They will assist them in making an application. But I've said is that their application will be considered in accordance with the housing allocation policy. That's not to say that someone will automatically be rehoused upon release, but that their application will be considered in line with the policy. Is in consideration in line with the policy, it means that the person meets the criteria for rehousing, they'll be rehoused. But they will be rehoused because they meet the housing criteria as opposed to an automatic rehousing because of the imprisonment. I hope that's clear.
Further questions. So, in so far as immediate homelessness is concerned, I assume so far as that criteria speeds up their process.
It will be treated in the same way as a case of homelessness is concerned. It's not an automatic case that someone who finishes serving a custodial sentence will be rehoused by the housing department. That person may have a house to go back to. If that person is likely to be vulnerable or at risk, because they are homeless, then the case will be treated as a homeless case in the same way that other cases are treated and will be given priority for them.
Question number 371, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassanam.
What is this government's policy in relation to allocating assisted living flats to old age pensioners?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, government does not have assisted living flats for old age pensioners. Mr. Speaker, firstly, can I just clarify the term I'm using so that the Minister understands the ones like CMOS, the Log, and Charles the Sun House, what are they known as? Mr. Speaker, those are flats that are purpose built for the elderly. They are not assisted living flats. Assisted living flats is something completely different and something that, in the UK, for example, assisted living flats for the elderly would have living assistance or some kind of care or assistance provided to them as part of the capital of the flat. The flats that we have are flats for elderly people, for pensioners, and the two latest flats that our government has built and it's been inaugurated recently have been specifically purposely built and are completely accessible for the needs of elderly people to help them live independently in the community. If these are the flats that the Honourable Lady is referring to, the flats that are Charles Wilson House and CMOS Lodge, etc., then the criteria used for allocating these is primarily for people who are elderly and are on the medical list. Allocations are also made on the people who may be on the housing exchange. So those are the two primary ways of people being rehoused in this flat that are purposely built for elderly.
In connection with that, the gentleman lady has just explained the criteria and the priority being given to those on the medical day list and so on, which I think is a well established one. However, Mr. Speaker, is the Minister like that? Is it correct that there are very elderly people on the medical list who have been led to believe that because they are renting from a private landlord at present and not from a government rental shop, that they will not be eligible to move into that? Can the Minister confirm or deny that those are going to make certain figures?
No, that's not the case at all, because those individuals are entitled to be applicants. And as applicants, if they are then considered to be on the medical list, and be on the medical list just like anybody else who is a current housing tenant. So it's not to say that only people who are housing tenants and on the exchange list are eligible for the elderly care. Some of them on the waiting list, depending on where they are at the stage, would be allocated one of these stuff, and indeed we have allocated one of these. So that is absolutely not true.
I'm just going to speak,
I know what elderly people, I really fall into that category of elderly people, I'm under 60 plus. I'm not saying that our ministry department has suddenly incorrect information they give, but elderly people can sometimes easily misunderstand. You know, there are those who, more than one person, you know, came out from some meetings at the housing ministry, so they say, yeah, but we've been told there's a huge disadvantage because you don't have a garment. Have to return back to factory stock, you know, something that I know previous diners have also at times actually used authority. That is an elderly couple, for example, could be occupying a 4RTB and on the medical list would benefit by moving down to RTB, for example, the digital services on house and the uses of 4RTB all over. But certainly, it is good news to hear that because someone is renting from the private sector, they're not necessarily included in the list. And therefore, if there are any still misunderstandings, I think that person will to the lady like we do in a couple of occasions.
And speaking of supplementary question, was actual disability. And I've been concerned that as long as people meet the criteria to be an applicant for housing and someone who is in a private rental would meet the criteria, then there is no reason why they can't be on there, and the rules are very clear, and I know that the department explains it very clearly. My supplementary was pretty much along the same lines as the Honourable gentleman on my right, but I have had a couple of complaints from constituents who feel that because they're not on the government tenants list and they are renting privately, all those companies want to be eligible to rent these older kinds of flats from a building that assisted living. So I would go back and tell them that they're not prejudiced in any way and they have the same rights as any existing government tenant. That is. Yes, what the department says when we consider allocation, because there's a difference between eligibility and your entitlement to be on the list, and how then your application is considered in the agency and the weight that you are given when allocation. At the time of allocation, we look at that who at that point on the list you need it most. So someone who is on the waiting list and is in a private rental that may be particularly old or frail and living in a flat that is extremely inaccessible for them, which means that they have a very poor quality of life, then that person would have priority over somebody who may be a bit fitter or a bit healthier and living in government rental accommodation, notwithstanding the fact that they were really rental accommodation. What the department does is they do a balancing exercise where they try and assist all the applicants on the list and also trying to look at everything in the land. So it all depends on the individual and the individual circumstances and the urgent need of the individual to be reaffirmed.
Question number 372, the Honourable Ms. Andy Hassanau.
What is the government policy in relation to government housing rental tenants who have a arrears agreement and parking space?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, household tenancies and parking spaces are not connected. As such, anyone with an agreement for payment of arrears of rent enters into an agreement in respect of the flat only. Anyone who is in arrears of rent is not entitled to additional benefits, and this includes a parking permit or a license to park in your city. Mr. Speaker, would the Minister for Housing understand that to those tenants who are paying their arrears, many of which have financial issues, which is what got them there in the first place, this policy to them is connected in the sense that it does punish those with arrears agreements because their parking spot gets removed and perhaps they depend on their cars to maybe take their kids to school or do the shopping or perhaps it's a very important part of their everyday living, and considering that they've come into an arrears agreement, and especially for those I suspect most of which are keeping kids, they feel like this parking spot removal is a punishment to them and to their lives. Would the Minister for Housing be willing to review such a policy? Well, Mr. Speaker, the starting point is that we're talking about people who don't pay their rent, but still can afford a car, and of course, the petrol and the insurance and all the inherent expenses of the vehicles. I have to say, Mr. Speaker, that there have been a couple of the states where the passing permits have expired in the last couple of months. There have been four states that have come to mind. And since we have listened to people informing them of the government policy that anybody in arrears of rent is not entitled to any extras, so it's not just the passing, the ability to avail themselves of the passing space that we are not making available anymore. So people are not entitled to have a birth, they need to have a certain other additional that go beyond the protection of being in your dwelling. The number of people who have automatically come in and paid lump sum, there have been people who have not paid rent in 10 years, 15 years, who for the sake of not leaving their party have paid their rent. So I don't agree with the Honourable Lady's premise that people cannot afford to pay the rent and that is why they're in arrears. In fact, some of the anecdotal information that I have from my office, who are meeting people who are coming in and clearing the arrears completely in the last couple of months when we started with dealing with the state where parking had expired, there was a gentleman came in and said, no, I cannot pay, let me pay you half of my arrears, which is a £2,000. But I pay you the other £1,000 in a few months' time because I'm staying on a cruise next week. And he said, right, so your parking stays, your permit expires in the next week. You can either pay it in full or you find yourself cramped when you come back to your cruise. And within 24 hours, the full lump sum was paid. Someone else paid a lump sum, incredibly enough, of £19,000 for as much to lose their parking stays. So, Mr. Speaker, all cases are considered on a case by case basis. Precisely, Mr. Speaker, and it is because, Mr. Speaker, we recognize what we do, Mr. Speaker, is we distinguish between la gente con la cara dura, Mr. Speaker, and people who genuinely cannot pay. And it's the caraduras, Mr. Speaker, who are not allowed the parking permit, because we do look at people in individual cases, and there have been exceptions made for people who we know are in genuine hardship, or people who may have a disability, and they therefore need their parking. But what we will not do it for, Mr. Speaker, is for the caradura. Only recently, another anecdote, Mr. Speaker, someone asked for us to know some exceptions to the parking permit, and when we looked at the household and the income, there were four people in the household in employment. All of them were in employment, and most of them were earning around £20,000, and the house owner was earning £40,000, Mr. Speaker. And the car for which they were seeking the permit, and they were asking us not to enforce the policy for the parking, was a brand new Mercedes Benz, Mr. Speaker. So, yes, caradura indeed. But it's for the caradura, Mr. Speaker, to whom this policy applies. And for the people who are in circumstances of genuine hardship, to whom it does not apply, Mr. Speaker. And it is because of the application of that policy, Mr. Speaker, that we have, for the first time, made tremendous inroads in the recovery of the world.
Question number 373, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please advise what was the cost of the graffiti mural painted in the northern side of Inter Hall, and what tender process was followed in selecting the office?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the total cost of the graffiti mural was £19,881.34. The acclaimed and highly regarded chief artist Ben Ames directly approached the government to undertake the job.
Mr. Speaker, if I then correctly understand the Minister, by the article directly approaching the government, obviously there was no tender process. Can I ask the Minister, £20,000 to paint the size of the building is not an inconsequential sum. How was the artistic merit of the proposal decided upon?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member asked about, first of all, about the tender. If someone wants to commission a Dalí, or a Picasso, or a Christian Hook, he do not go out to tender. That's the first thing. If they look, yes, that's what I have to go in. But you couldn't acquire a Picasso or a Dalí because they're both just Mr. Speaker. Anyway, the point is that if you want to, somebody who's an artist, a brilliant artist, to do a job, you ask them, here's the wall, do your art, which is the second point that the Honourable Member actually said. We do not tell the artist what they have to do. It's their skill, their profession to do what they need to do with the wall. And that was the case with Benin, who is, like I said, an acclaimed artist, street artist, who wanted to do a street art. We gave him the opportunity of using that wall, and he produced that magnificent, fantastic painting which is there. This is a subjective thing, and therefore, people might like the wall in gray, and I might like it in orange. The artist believed at the time that what he painted in the wall was what should have been done. So, there might be people that like it, might be people that don't like it. All I can tell you is it's attracting loads of tourists taking photographs because of the magnificent painting on that wall.
Mr. Speaker, indeed, the artist is in the eye of the beholder. But can I ask the Minister, I mean, how was the decision made? I mean, was there an art appreciation committee within the cultural agency that decided these things, or was it purely a subjective matter for himself? And then I ask one further question, how was it that the artist approached the Dvorka government? What are his connections to the Dvorka? And are there any plans for him to do any further such new work in Dvorka? Mr. Speaker, the artist approached me through his girlfriend, who was a secretary. This is an impression of international renowned street artist. And he said through that route to the government of Gibraltar, I would be delighted to paint a wall in Gibraltar. Gentleman has a huge following. People travel to see his art around the world. He's just finished doing something in Buenos Aires. He's done a number of things in Spain and in the United Kingdom. He was very well connected to somebody, the noble gentleman may have heard of, Banksy. He painted with Banksy for many years, and then was very closely linked to Banksy. So this is not a question of the government deciding if it wanted to speak out of that form. This is an artist who approached the government and said, I would be delighted if you give me a wall to paint. I'll speak out. And depending on what wall, the difference of the thing would have been painted. The wall proposed by the government was Interpol, which is related to entertainment. So, in his view, because he is the artist, he thought it made sense to paint that entertainment. I think it's a magnificent depiction of what has gone on in that building for many hundreds of years, and the way of making that building modern for a while. But as Mr. Ben himself said on television, all he's put on the building is paint. It can be taken down when the time comes to be a full refurbishment of that building in the style of the Gibraltar International Bank, which the refurbishment Minister Isra led on and given admitted himself on. Now, I don't know whether there is such a thing as an arbitrary taste, but most artists decide for themselves what it is that they put on whatever they are invited to use as canvas. Frankly, from my point of view,
as somebody who has no understanding of art, and it's just a layman who sees things that he likes and things that he doesn't like, and some of the things I like, art critics think are horrible, and some of the things I dislike, art critics think are magnificent. I happen to think this is magnificent, because it really shows, in a piece of modern street art, what the Interpol is all about. It's smarter than it was, and I'd like to use this opportunity to thank Ben Owen for having come to Gibraltar, for having decorated an historic building like the Interpol, as he has. It's not something that's going to be there forever, because the building will be refurbished in the style of the whole of that area in some appropriate moment. But I'm delighted that we've been able to have Ben Owen come to Gibraltar. We will intend to do so. We've really just paid for paying some accommodation and for him to come and his request. And I think that part of Gibraltar is smarter and it's more fun as a result of this magnificent piece of street art. It might be said, well, Mr. Speaker, it might not even be said on this side of the house. It may not be said on that side of the house. It may be said by many outside, it may be said by those few outside. Beauty, Mr. Speaker, is in the eye of the beholder. And I reckon that it would take this day for the Honourable Gentleman opposite. Might have loved it. But look, at the end of the day, that's entertainment.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the keeping the intervention and the acceptance of responsibility for the choice of artists and the fact that they seem to have painted on that wall. And I listen to add that I have always been a great admirer of art, albeit a lot of the art now in the form of Christian Hook. I cannot afford that action. If I may ask the Speaker for just one supplementary then on this subject, is there any intention of any further art to be done in Gibraltar by this particular artist, or indeed any other street artist? As regards the choice of colour of beige, no, perhaps white would have been better at a much lower cost of £5,000 for waterproofing, but never mind.
Mr. Speaker, I've had a magnificent choice before me. And the Honourable Gentleman has said that I took responsibility for the choice of artists. I had an absolutely magnificent choice of artists. I had one artist to volunteer. So, given that choice, Mr. Speaker, I felt £20 to give it to him. Given that nobody else had volunteered to give us of their time, nobody else in international renown, or indeed at all, had offered to give us of their time to create this piece of choice. So, I will take full responsibility for making the choice out of the one that was available. There is a programme of street art, which is not my responsibility, the responsibility of the Ministry of Culture, and a co-liaison with the Ministry for the Environment, which will shortly be rolled out. I don't think we should be prompted to make an announcement about that now, because I think it's an exciting opportunity, which many other cities are taking, which does not involve much painting in beige or in white, which is one of the things that obviously quite love. And Mr. Speaker, I think that modernising the city at the same time as being militant in the preservation of its heritage is what the future is all about, and that's what this government is all about.
Question number 374, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister put forth Benefit House with full details pertaining to the sale for use of any sporting wire facilities such as the Victoria Stadium to the Gibraltar Football Association?
I answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
The Speaker will answer this question together with question 375.
Question number 375, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Sport furnish this House with full details of its intention, if any, to reutilise or recite sporting facilities which may be lost for public use at the Victoria Stadium to face a sports complex as a result of the arrangements it has entered into with the World Football Association?
I answer the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, both these questions will be answered in detail in the budget statement, which I will be delivering early next week.
I understand that, Mr. Speaker, but however, it won't allow me to sort of, you know, close any supplementary questions given the information that has come forward. I don't know, perhaps your guidance.
I will, unless the Honourable Mr. Ray speaks before, if you speak before the Minister, then you have a problem. If you speak after the Minister, you will be able, in your own contribution, to raise matters which you are interested in and which you may or may not have covered. In any case, given that you have put these questions and they have not been told for the answer, I will be liberal, and I would hope the Minister would also be liberal if you ask him to give way and to answer any specific matters that you may deal with.
Mr. Speaker, I can give assistance to the House. I am intending to inform the House that we should be taking the budget debate to the Appropriation Bill on Monday. The Honourable the Deputy suggests the House a proposed draft order of speakers that will circulate, if we can agree as usual, the order of our intervention. And the Honourable General is pleased to see that he will be speaking in our proposal, just like last year, after the Honourable Gentleman's hearing. In fact, I think 4 or 5 after the Honourable Gentleman's hearing, we have an opportunity to tailor his congratulations to the Honourable Gentleman for the announcement he will make in good time.
If the Honourable Mr. Reyes deals in your contribution with issues that you would have tackled in supplementary, then I would give the Minister the opportunity, if you give way to him, to read with those countries.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I think we do that. And I think it implies what you were saying. If as a result of all that and sort of digesting and the answers, should I then need to come up with a formal oral question or whatever I tell you in the December session, I'm sure Mr. Speaker will deliver the last week and ask to allow me to pose the question despite not being specific on time because of what happened. Is that the same? Then I'm satisfied with what has been explained in the speaker.